Hello, and welcome back to True Crime Cat Lawyer. I'm your host, Elise. Every week, I share true crime cases from my hometown of the Pacific Northwest. My goal is to create ethical true crime content and educate others about the legal/criminal justice system. Please be sure to follow us on social media at True Crime Cat Lawyer for Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and True Crime Cat Law on Twitter. And please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or a rating on Spotify. We also have a Patreon page, which is linked in our show notes. Or you can head to patreon.com to join for just $5 a month. All proceeds from our Patreon are donated to animal rescues and shelters. Finally, we now have an Etsy sticker shop where you can buy true crime and cat stickers. Again, all proceeds from the sticker shop are donated to animal rescues and shelters. The link to the sticker shop is in our show notes, but you can also find us by searching True Crime Cat Lawyer in Etsy. As always, this podcast contains content of a graphic nature, including physical and sexual violence, suicide, and crimes against animals and children. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, and welcome back to the show. Before we get started, I want to add an extra trigger warning here. This episode will discuss rape, so please listen with caution. Amanda Stavick, better known as Mandy, grew up in Acme, Washington, about an hour and a half north of Seattle. Mandy's parents were divorced, and her mom, Mary, moved the kids to Acme from Alaska. Acme is a tiny town in Whatcom County. It was described as a place where people didn't lock their doors. Mandy was described as bright and vivacious, and she was athletic. She rode horseback, played softball, ran track, and played basketball in high school. Mandy was also an honor student and a cheerleader. At the time this case took place, in 1989, Mandy was 18 years old, having just graduated from Mount Baker High School, and she was a freshman at Central Washington University. On November 22, 1989, Mandy and her roommate Yoko hitched a ride home for Thanksgiving break with Mandy's ex-boyfriend, Rick Zender. He was also a student at Central Washington. Zender dropped the ladies off around 2 p.m. Later that afternoon, Mandy went to visit some friends at her former high school while they were at basketball practice. The next day was Thanksgiving, so Mandy spent the whole day with her family. On November 24th, Mandy hung out with her family in the morning, eating leftovers. Then, Mandy and Yoko took a walk. They made plans to go out later that night with one of Mandy's high school friends, Brad Gorham, and his friend, Tom Bass. But Mandy wanted to get in a quick run before that. So between 2 and 3 p.m. that afternoon, Mandy took her German Shepherd, Kyra, for a run. Her typical route took her down Strand Road, where her house was, to the Nooksack River. Then she'd loop back around. The route was about 5 miles round trip. There was conflicting evidence about the actual route that Mandy ran on November 24th, but her brother and another eyewitness saw her running east toward her house around 3 p.m. And according to the eyewitness, Mandy was just a few minutes away from being home. After Mandy didn't come home in her normal time frame, her mom started to get worried. Mandy's mom got in touch with Rick Zender. Mandy and Rick had met in high school, and they had been dating on and off for about 3 years. Rick didn't have any information on where Mandy was. So Mandy's mom called neighbors and other friends to see if anyone had seen or heard from Mandy. Mandy's brother and mom then went out looking for Mandy in their neighborhood, but there was no sign of her. Shortly after their search, Kyra the dog came home without Mandy. Quote, the dog cowered with tail tucked and had river silt, aka sand, covering part of her hindquarters, end quote. Mandy's friend Brad Gorham, her ex-boyfriend Rick, and Tom Bass all came to the Stavick home to help look for Mandy. Around 5:30 p.m., Mandy's mom called Whatcom County Search and Rescue. Human tracker Alan Pratt responded and started his own search for Mandy. He found a disturbed spot on the shoulder of the road near the corner closest to the Stavick home. He also found several footprints, possibly from two different people. It, quote, looked like somebody had been walking or wrestling around or something, end quote. The nearby grass had also been disturbed, and Pratt found river silt / sand in a nearby ditch that matched what was found on Kira the dog. 3 days later, on November 27th, Mandy's body was found in a shallow part of the Nooksack River just 6 miles from her home. This was significantly upstream from where Mandy was last seen. Mandy had only her socks and shoes on. Her body was covered in scratches, including her legs, buttocks, and arms. Most of the scratches were parallel, indicating that Mandy was moving when she was scratched. The appearance of the scratches suggested that they occurred while Mandy was still alive. Police found footprints and tire tracks in a nearby field known as the Homestead. The Homestead was a local isolated hangout spot for teens. Unfortunately, police couldn't definitively determine whether the footprints and tire tracks were related to Mandy's case because of the number of people who'd been in that area. No other tracks or disturbances were found near the riverbank at the spot where Mandy's body was found. An autopsy was performed on November 28, 1989. There were no defensive wounds on Mandy's hands, no foreign DNA under her fingernails, and no evidence of strangulation. The coroner found a blunt force trauma injury to Mandy's forehead on the right side. He later testified that this blow would have caused a significant concussion, but he couldn't say whether Mandy lost consciousness because of it. He would also later testify that the blunt force trauma injury happened either right before or right after Mandy's death. The coroner ruled Mandy's cause of death as drowning. This puzzled Mandy's family because Mandy was a strong swimmer and the water in the river was shallow. But if Mandy was knocked unconscious before she went into the water, she wouldn't have been able to swim and could have easily drowned. The coroner ruled the manner of death as undetermined because he couldn't conclusively determine the manner in which she died. Based on Mandy's stomach contents, the coroner estimated that Mandy died within 3 to 4 hours of her last meal. Mandy's family testified that she ate before her walk with Yoko on the day she went missing between 11:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. That placed Mandy's time of death between 3:30 p.m. and 4:30 p.m. Semen was found in Mandy's vagina. The coroner believed that sexual intercourse took place no more than 12 hours before Mandy's death. The semen samples were preserved and sent to both the FBI and the Washington State Patrol Crime Lab. The crime lab was able to create a DNA profile from the semen sample, but there were no matches in the system. There were several suspects in the case, but each one was ruled out by DNA comparison. Despite the fact that Mandy's death rocked the small community of Acme, her case eventually went cold. Investigators looked into the possibility that Mandy was the victim of the Green River Killer, who was active around this time, but her death didn't fit the profile of Gary Ridgway. For years, police had nothing to go on. They had no leads, no tips, no persons of interest, and no suspects. In 2009, the case was reopened. Detectives asked for DNA samples from anyone who lived in the area or may have had contact with Mandy around the time of her death. They collected 80-plus DNA samples for testing, but there was still no match. In 2013, two old acquaintances of Tim Bass, the brother of Mandy's acquaintance, Tom Bass, reported a tip about Tim to police. It's not clear what the tip was, but investigators decided to interview Tim Bass. Detectives asked Tim for a DNA sample. Tom and his brother Tim grew up near the Staviks back in the 80s. Tim, who I'm going to refer to as Bass for the rest of this episode, was 3 years older than Mandy. He'd gone to high school basketball games while Mandy was a player. Despite this, Bass told detectives that he didn't really know Mandy. He also lied and said that he didn't know where Mandy lived. Bass declined to provide a DNA sample to police without a warrant. In February 2015, police again contacted Bass. He still wouldn't budge on the DNA sample without a warrant. Police didn't have a warrant or a subpoena, so they couldn't compel any sample from Bass. But police wouldn't give up that easily. They tracked down Bass's employer, Fran's Bakery, where he worked as a delivery driver. They reached out to Bass's supervisor, Kim Wagner, to try and get the company's consent to swab their delivery trucks for touch DNA. This was a general request, not specific to Bass or his delivery truck. Kim told police that they'd have to run the request up the chain of command, i.e., they'd have to get permission from the company in order to perform a search. But the company refused to give permission to allow police to search its trucks. 2 years later, in May 2017, police contacted Kim again to ask for a copy of Bass's delivery route. Kim asked police if they were investigating Bass and Mandy's murder, and they confirmed. The lead detective told Kim that he was looking for things that Bass might throw away that could have his DNA. Kim then provided information about Bass's route to police. Bass was placed under surveillance while he was driving his regular route in the hope that they could collect discarded cigarette butts, water bottles, anything he might have drank from, or anything that Bass might have eaten and thrown away. Detectives told Kim that they weren't able to find anything that Bass had thrown away, so Kim said that she would check to see if Bass had thrown anything away at work, if that would help them. Detectives said okay, but they made it clear that they weren't asking her to do anything for them. In August 2017, Kim saw Bass drink water from a plastic cup, which he then threw in the trash, in the break room. Kim grabbed the cup and put it in a plastic bag in her desk. A few days later, Kim saw Bass drinking a can of soda. After he threw away the can in the trash, Kim collected the can and put it with the cup. Kim then texted the detective to let him know that she'd collected two items with Bass's DNA on them. Detectives met Kim in the parking lot of the Franz Bakery to pick up the items and sent them to the crime lab for analysis. When the DNA testing results came back, the DNA was a 1 in 11 quadrillion match to Tim Bass. Police finally had their man. Bass was arrested in December 2017. Before we talk about the court proceedings, let's go back to 2015 real quick, when police contacted Bass for the second time. After that visit, Bass got nervous. He told his brother Tom that he was worried because he'd had sex with Mandy during her Thanksgiving break back in 1989. Bass then told his brother that he and Mandy had slept together a few times before she went off to college. Bass told his brother Tom to tell police that he also slept with Mandy to make it seem like Mandy, quote-unquote, slept around. A few days after talking to his brother, Bass then talked to his mom. Bass wanted his mom to agree to tell the police that his dead dad killed Mandy, but his mom said no. After Bass was arrested in 2017, his brother and mom visited him in jail a few times. Tom would testify at trial about a statement that his brother made during one of the visits. Quote, he said the cops were lying and everyone was out to get him. He said, they're going to kill me in here. I need a strong alibi or I'm going to prison, end quote. Bass then asked his mom to say that they were Christmas shopping together on the day that Mandy went missing. Bass tried to explain away his DNA by telling investigators he had a secret sexual relationship with Mandy, but there was absolutely no evidence that this was true, and it was in direct contradiction to his earlier claims that he didn't have any contact with Mandy and barely knew her. Also, none of the witnesses who testified at trial, including Mandy's mom, her neighbors, and her friends, ever saw Mandy with Bass. Bass was charged with first-degree murder, but he maintained his innocence and denied any involvement with Mandy's murder. So who was Tim Bass? Like I mentioned, he was a neighbor of the Staviks back in 1989. Despite the fact that he lived on the same road as the Staviks, he wasn't contacted by authorities back in 1989. Mandy frequently jogged past Bass's house on her normal route. Bass got married in 1990 and moved to Everson, Washington, about 30 minutes northwest of Acme. He and his wife had three kids. Bass's wife described him as very controlling. His wife originally provided him with an alibi for the day of the murder, telling police that Bass was with her all day, even though that wasn't true. The couple eventually got divorced, which is when his wife told police that the alibi was a lie. Bass had made her provide him with that alibi. Bass had no prior criminal history in Washington, but he was accused of physical abuse by his ex-wife in 2010. Bass's trial was 3 weeks long. His brother Tom testified for the prosecution, telling the judge and jury about being approached by Bass to lie and provide an alibi for him. Bass's ex-wife also testified. She said that both she and Bass had seen Mandy run past their house from their upstairs bedroom window. Bass's defense attorney tried to argue that the police's collection of the soda can was illegal, but the judge ruled that the DNA sample was admissible as evidence. Bass didn't testify in his own defense. On May 24, 2019, the jury convicted Bass of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to the maximum of 320 months, or roughly 27 years, in prison. Immediately after his conviction, Bass filed an appeal to the Washington Court of Appeals. Bass argued that he didn't receive a fair trial. He had a few arguments to present. First, he said that the DNA sample shouldn't have been admitted as evidence because Kim Wagner, his supervisor, was, quote, an agent of the state or was acting on behalf of law enforcement, end quote, when she collected the sample, which was illegal. Second, Bass argued that there was insufficient evidence to show that he raped and kidnapped Mandy. Third, he argued that the judge should have allowed the defense to present Mandy's diary entries at trial. And finally, he argued that the judge applied the incorrect version of the felony murder rule to his case. I want to talk about each of his arguments and then tell you about how the court ruled. So let's start with the agent of the state slash acting on behalf of law enforcement argument. To prove that a private citizen was acting as a government agent, a defendant has to show that the state, quote, in some way instigated, encouraged, counseled, directed, or controlled the conduct, end quote, of the private citizen. In other words, there must be some evidence that the government in some way prompted or motivated the actions of the private citizen. Keeping that burden of proof in mind, was Kim Wagner acting on behalf of the state slash law enforcement when she collected the cup and soda can? Well, the Court of Appeals said no. Kim was the one who decided to search the trash and collect those items. Detectives didn't direct, entice, or instigate her search of the trash. The lead detective testified at trial that he didn't direct Kim to take any items, nor did he tell her how to handle any items she might come across or how to package those items for evidence preservation. Kim testified at trial that she felt a quote-unquote moral obligation to assist with the investigation. She also testified that she had assumed that she would need to collect something with Bass's saliva on it based on her husband's experience doing an ancestry DNA test. Police never told her this information. Based on Kim and the detective's testimonies, the court found there was no evidence of police instigation, police encouragement, or police control over Kim Wagner's activities. Bass's appeal attorneys also made an alternative argument. The detectives instigated and encouraged Kim's search by asking her for Bass's delivery route. But Kim herself testified that the route was public knowledge. She also reiterated that she was acting on her own quote-unquote moral obligation when she took the cup and soda can. The defense's last-ditch argument about the DNA sample and the search was that Bass had a privacy interest in his saliva. But the Washington Supreme Court had previously rejected that argument in another case when the collection of the saliva didn't involve a, quote, invasive or involuntary collection procedure, end quote. Because Kim was collecting the saliva samples from the trash, there was no invasive or involuntary collection. Bass threw away the items and he had no reasonable expectation of privacy in any saliva that he'd thrown away. The next issue the court addressed was Bass's assertion that the state didn't have sufficient evidence to show that he kidnapped and raped Mandy. But the court found that there was both sufficient direct and circumstantial evidence to prove that Bass abducted and raped Mandy before she died. The state offered evidence of Bass's sexual attraction to Mandy, the lack of an alibi and his absence from home at the time of Mandy's death, Bass's admission that he was at the homestead field around the time that Mandy died, and Bass's admission that he had sex with Mandy around the time she went missing and was murdered. Bass's appeal attorneys also argued that the judge should have allowed them to present Mandy's diary entries for the year prior to her murder. Mandy's diary entries were what a typical 18-year-old in college would write about. She had entries about her friends, her mom, and her boyfriend. She also wrote about struggles with her weight, her sleeping habits, and her future. Again, totally normal for a young woman with her whole life ahead of her. But the defense had three specific entries that they tried to admit into evidence at trial. The first was dated March 17, 1989. Mandy wrote that she had thought about suicide. A few weeks later, on April 2nd, Mandy wrote that she was depressed and hated life. Then, on June 23rd, Mandy wrote that she questioned whether life was, quote, worthwhile, end quote. The defense wanted these specific diary entries to be admitted as evidence to allegedly show Mandy's state of mind, i.e., that she was suicidal. And they wanted to show this evidence because the coroner said he couldn't definitively determine the manner of death. But the trial judge ruled that the suicide theory was too speculative. The entries the defense pointed out didn't prove either directly or circumstantially that Mandy was suicidal at the time she died in November 1989. In fact, between the entry from June up until her death in November, the judge said that Mandy wrote with, quote, great enthusiasm, end quote, about college life and hanging out with her friends and family. The Court of Appeals agreed with the trial judge. They said that because the link between the diary entries and any alleged suicidal thoughts that Mandy might have had was too speculative, the diary entries were properly excluded as irrelevant. The last argument Bass's attorneys made was that the wrong version of the felony murder rule was applied in Bass's case. According to his attorneys, the 1990 version of the law was applied to his case instead of the 1989 version. They argued the 1989 version was the appropriate law to apply because the crime happened in 1989. So let's discuss the two versions, starting with the 1989 law. This version required prosecutors to prove that Bass committed the crime of kidnapping, and in the course of and in furtherance of that crime, he caused the death of Mandy. In other words, the state had to prove both the in the course of and in furtherance of elements. The 1990 version is similar, but it's different in one key aspect. This version required the state to prove that Bass committed the crime of kidnapping, and in the course of or in the furtherance of that crime, he caused the death of Mandy. This version gave the state the option of proving either the in the course of or the in furtherance of elements, but it didn't require both to be established for someone to be convicted of felony murder. Bass was convicted under the 1990 version, which had or instead of and. Bass's defense attorneys essentially argued that applying the wrong version of the law entitled Bass to a new trial. The Court of Appeals agreed that the wrong version of the law was applied to the case, but they disagreed that this entitled Bass to a new trial. They looked at the issue through a harmless error analysis. Under this analysis, prejudice to the defendant is assumed, so it's up to the state to prove that the error made was harmless to the defendant beyond a reasonable doubt. The court noted that Mandy died while trying to get away from Bass. Therefore, it was in the course of the crime of kidnapping that Mandy died, because kidnapping is what's known as a continuing crime. That means that the crime of kidnapping continues until the victim is able to get away or reach safety. The court felt that the state did prove that the jury would have found Bass caused Mandy's death in the course of and in furtherance of her kidnapping beyond a reasonable doubt. This was based on the idea that kidnapping is a continuing crime and Bass killed Mandy to keep her from getting away from him slash preventing her from telling police what he did to her. The Court of Appeals held that any error that was made in convicting Bass under the 1990 version of the felony murder rule was harmless. Therefore, Bass's conviction was upheld in June 2021. Bass filed a petition for review to the Washington Supreme Court in September 2021. His petition for review was denied by the court in January 2022. Bass is currently incarcerated at Clallam Bay Correction Center under close custody, which means he has less freedom of movement. His tentative release date is set for sometime in January 2036. Thank you for listening to this episode. Please subscribe to the show on whatever podcast app you're currently listening on. If you haven't already, we'd appreciate it if you left a review or rating of our show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. All of our sources for this episode can be found in our show notes. If you're interested in supporting our show, you can join our Patreon for just $5 a month. The link is in our show notes, but you can also go to patreon.com/truecrimecatlawyer. Patreon members receive bonus content, a shout out in an episode, and other goodies throughout the year. Patreon members also get an exclusive promo code and sticker when they shop in our Etsy store. Speaking of our Etsy shop, You can find the link to the shop in our show notes or search for True Crime Cat Lawyer on Etsy. We have all kinds of true crime and cat stickers, plus some true crime beaded pens. All of the proceeds from our Patreon and Etsy shop are donated to animal rescues and shelters. This is an important mission of ours, and we've proudly donated to over 11 organizations so far. And last but not least, if you're interested in learning more about Podcat Winston, you can find her on Instagram at WinstonTheCatPDX. Thanks again for listening, and stay tuned for our next episode.